Do you love someone who is an addict? Whether the addiction is to drugs, alcohol, or behaviors such as gambling or pornography, addictions are so widespread in our society that it almost goes without saying that there's scarcely anyone whose family or social circle has been untouched by addiction. In my years in ministry, I've sat with so many people in grief and despair because a loved one, often a child, has been lost to drugs. Great parents with other kids who are not addicted. Tragic, confusing losses and damage. It's now just about a century since drugs were first banned in North America, and all through this long century of waging war on drugs, we've been told a story about addiction by our teachers and by our governments. I'm sorry, there's people wondering, are you getting what you need? Okay, just wondering. So we've been told a story about addiction by our teachers and by our governments. This story is so deeply ingrained in our minds that we take it for granted. It seems obvious, it seems manifestly true. But what some researchers and investigative journalists, such as the British writer Johann Hari, have found is that almost everything we've been told about addiction may well be completely wrong, and that there's a very different story waiting for us if only we're ready to hear it. What causes some people to become fixated on a drug or behavior until they can't stop, and how do we help those people come back to us? If asked about what causes drug addiction, we would probably answer, drugs. It seems so obvious. Imagine if you and I and the next 20 people to pass us on the street take a really potent drug for 20 days. There are strong chemical hooks in these drugs, so if we stopped on day 21, our bodies would need that chemical. We would have a ferocious craving. We'd be addicted. That's what addiction means. This view was injected into our thoughts, in part by a famous TV ad. You may remember it, though I don't know if it was shown in Canada. It related a famous experiment that was done with rats. The experiment is simple. Put a rat in a cage alone, along with two water bottles. One water bottle just has water in it. The other is water laced with heroin or cocaine. Almost every time you run this experiment, the rat will become obsessed with the drugged water and keep coming back for more and more until it kills itself. The ad explained, only one drug is so addictive. 9 out of 10 laboratory rats will use it and use it and use it until dead. It's called cocaine, and it can do the same thing to you. But in the 1970s, a professor of psychology in Vancouver named Bruce Alexander noticed something odd about this experiment. The rat is put in the cage all alone. It has nothing to do but take drugs. What would happen, he wondered, if we tried this differently? So Professor Alexander built Rat Park. Rat Park was a lush cage where the rats had colored balls and the best rat food and tunnels to scamper down and plenty of friends to play with, everything a rat could want. What, Professor Alexander wondered, will happen then? In Rat Park, all the rats tried both water bottles because they didn't know what was in them, but what happened next was startling. The rats with good lives didn't like the drugged water. They mostly shunned it, consuming less than a quarter of the drugs that the isolated rats had used. None of them died. While all the rats who were alone and unhappy became heavy users, none of the rats who had a happy environment did. At the same time as the Rat Park experiment, the Vietnam War was going on. Time magazine reported that heroin was as common as chewing gum among U.S. soldiers, and indeed some 20% of the soldiers had become addicted to heroin there. Many people back home were understandably terrified. They believed a huge influx of addicts were about to head home when the war ended. But in fact, some 95% of the addicted soldiers simply stopped once they were back home. Very few had rehab. They shifted from a terrifying cage back to a pleasant one, so they didn't want the drug anymore. Professor Alexander argues this discovery is a profound challenge to our usual views of drug addiction. It's a challenge to the right-wing view that addiction is a moral failing, and it's a challenge to the liberal view that addiction is a disease taking place in a chemically hijacked brain. In fact, he argues addiction is an adaptation. It's not you, it's your cage. By the way, I encourage feedback, grunting or cheering or saying, or whatever. Whatever. This is controversial stuff, and I'm not saying I know it's right. I'm just introducing some very eye-opening and, for me, quite revolutionary ideas. So after the first phase of Rat Park, Professor Alexander then took this test further. He reran the earlier experiments where the rats were left alone and became compulsive users of the drug. He let them use the drug for 57 days. If anything can hook you, it's that. Then he took them out of isolation and put them into Rat Park. He wanted to know, if you fall into that state of addiction, is your brain hijacked so you can't recover? Do the drugs take you over? What happened is, again, striking. The rats seemed to have a few twitches of withdrawal, but they soon stopped their heavy use and went back to having a normal life. The good cage, the cage with the interesting activities, a variety of food, and plenty of social interaction, saved them. This new theory is such a radical assault on what we've been told that it feels as if it can't possibly be true. But as journalist Johann Hari says, the more scientists I interviewed and the more I looked at their studies, the more I discovered things that don't seem to make much sense unless you take account of this new approach. Here's one example of an experiment that is happening all around us and may well happen to you or me one day. If you get run over today and you break your hip, you will probably be given diamorphine, the medical name for heroin. In the hospital around you, there will be plenty of people also given heroin for long periods for pain relief. The heroin you will get from the doctor will have a much higher purity and potency than the heroin being used by street addicts who have to buy from criminals who adulterate it. So if the old theory of addiction is right, it's the drugs that cause it, they make your body need them, then it's obvious that what should happen. Loads of people should leave the hospital and try to score smack on the streets to meet their habit. But the strange thing is, it virtually never happens. As the Canadian doctor Gabor Maté explained, the vast majority of medical users just stop, despite months of use. The same drug used for the same length of time turns street users into desperate addicts and leaves medical patients unaffected. In a recent talk, Dr. Maté dedicated the evening to the memory of a woman he called Serena. One of the many faces of addiction on the downtown east side of Vancouver, Serena was a young woman ravaged by severe sexual abuse, neglect, and dysfunction. And her death, in Maté's words, is indicative of a massive failure of society, science, and compassion. Reflecting on Serena's death, Dr. Mate said, "This is not a war on drugs. This is a war on drug addicts. We ask ourselves why people give up their lives, their relationships, their connections in this world for the pursuit of a drug. Addiction can never be understood if looked at through the lens of moralism and judgment." He says, "It's time, as a society, we ask not why the addiction, but why the pain." The street addict is like the rats in the first cage, isolated, alone, with only one source of solace to turn to. The medical patient is like the rats in the second cage, the friendly rat park. She's going home to a life where she is surrounded by the people she loves. The drug is the same, but the environment is different. Dr. Mate traces most addictions back to deprivations and abuse in early childhood, which inhibit the developing brain from growing the ability to produce its own natural drugs. Dr. Mate says the first 5 years of life and even the environment in the womb can dictate a predisposition to addiction, and he uses recent studies to connect stress, abuse, and lack of love and attachment to deficiencies in our ability to create endorphins and dopamine, necessary chemicals in our bodies that give us both pleasure and pain relief. Mate claims it's no coincidence that emotional and physical pain are interpreted in the same place in the brain and lead us to self-medicate when we are lacking these receptors. He suggests that addicts are not addicted to the substance at all, but rather to their own brain chemicals. Professor Peter Cohen argues that human beings have a deep need to bond and form connections. It's how we get our satisfaction. If we can't connect with each other, we will connect with anything we can find, the whir of a roulette wheel or the prick of a syringe. He says that we should stop talking about addiction altogether and instead call it bonding. A heroin addict has bonded with heroin because she couldn't bond as fully with anything else. So the opposite of addiction is not sobriety. It is human connection. This has huge implications for the century-old war on drugs. This massive and destructive war is based on the claim that we need to physically eradicate a whole array of chemicals because they hijack people's brains and cause addiction. But if drugs aren't the driver of addiction, if in fact it is disconnection that drives addiction, then this makes no sense. Ironically, the war on drugs actually increases all those larger drivers of addiction. Johann Hari went to a prison in Arizona called Tent City, where inmates are detained in tiny stone isolation cages for weeks and weeks on end to punish them for drug use. He says it is as close to a human recreation of the cages that guaranteed deadly addiction in rats as I can imagine. And when those prisoners get out, they will be unemployable because of their criminal record, guaranteeing they will be cut off even more. There is an alternative. You can build a system that is designed to help drug addicts to reconnect with the world and so leave behind their addictions. This isn't theoretical. It is happening. Does anybody know what country this is happening in? Sixteen years ago, Portugal had one of the worst drug problems in Europe, with 1% of the population addicted to heroin. 1% of the population. They had tried a drug war, and the problem just kept getting worse. They decided to do something radically different. They resolved to decriminalize all drugs and transfer all the money they used to spend on arresting and jailing drug addicts and spend it instead on reconnecting them to their own feelings and to the wider society. The most crucial step is to get them secure housing, subsidized jobs so they have a purpose in life and something to get out of bed for. They are helped in warm and welcoming clinics to learn how to reconnect with their feelings after years of trauma and stunning their feelings into silence with drugs. An independent study found that since total decriminalization in Portugal, addiction has fallen and injecting drug use is down by 50%. Injecting drug use is down by 50% in 16 years. Decriminalization has been such a manifest success that very, very few people in Portugal want to go back to the old system. The main campaigner against the decriminalization back in 2000 was João Figueira, the country's top drug cop. He offered all the dire warnings that we would expect before the change happened. But now he says that everything he predicted had not come to pass. And he now hopes the whole world will follow Portugal's example. This isn't only relevant to the addicts we love. It is relevant to all of us because it forces us to think differently about ourselves. Human beings are bonding animals. We need to connect and love. But we've created an environment and a culture that cut us off from connection or offer only the parody of it offered by the internet. Speaking as an internet addict myself. The rise of addiction is a symptom of a deeper sickness in the way we live, constantly directing our gaze towards the next shiny object we should buy rather than the human beings all around us. The writer George Monbiot has called this the age of loneliness. We have created human societies where it's easier for people to become cut off from all human connections than ever before. Bruce Alexander, the creator of Rat Park, says that for too long we have talked exclusively about individual recovery from addiction. We need to talk now about social recovery, how we all recover together from the sickness of isolation that is sinking on us like a thick fog. But this new evidence isn't just a challenge to us politically. It doesn't just force us to change our minds. It forces us, or invites us, to change our hearts. We are hungry for something that feeds more than bodies. Loving an addict is extremely hard. I was talking to a parishioner of mine the other day who was in tears, telling me about her 30-something son who has a disastrous gambling addiction and has stolen from her. It is always tempting to follow the tough love advice. Tell the addict to shape up or cut them off. The message there is that an addict who won't stop should be shunned. But in fact, that will only deepen their addiction and you may lose them altogether. The challenge, and I don't know how this is done, but the challenge is to tie the addicts in your life closer than ever, to let them know you love them unconditionally, whether they stop or whether they don't. Protecting yourself, setting limits where you must, but loving them. Dr. Nora Volkoff, one of the United States' most prominent drug addiction researchers, says that not only love and connection, but also an interesting, meaningful, stimulating environment make people less likely to turn to addictions. Volkoff thinks that drugs and other addictive habits tap into some of the deepest forces within us. Our lust for newness, our yearning for vitality, and the deep down thrill of being alive. We all seek that intensity, she says. There's something very powerful about that. This urge to connect to the world and learn from it is more important than mere pleasure, says Volkoff. It's part of the most basic force in behavior, the will to live. It's not automatic, she points out. Seriously ill or very depressed people can lose the will to survive. What is the motivation we all have to be alive, to do things, she asks. It's not pleasure. Our lives would be so much simpler if we were motivated just for the sake of pleasure. If you connect to the world in a meaningful way and have more chances to get excited about natural stimuli, you're less likely to need an artificial boost. Dr. Volkoff says, if you don't get excited by everyday things in life, if things look gray and the drug makes things look extraordinary, that puts you at risk. She says, but if you get great excitement, I love Dr. Volkoff. She sounds like a pistol. She says, but if you get great excitement out of a great multiplicity of things and intensely enjoy these things, seeing a movie or climbing a mountain, and then you try a drug, you'll think, what's the big deal? For those lucky enough to be surrounded by sharp minds and stimulating experiences, drugs are just nowhere near as interesting as everyday life. We are hungry for something that feeds more than bodies. As shown in the exhaustive studies conducted by economic researchers who wrote The Spirit Level, all manner of societal ills can be directly correlated to the amount of economic inequality in the society. Comparing industrialized nations' rates of drug use, there's a dramatic correlation. Japan, where there's very little economic inequality, has very little drug use. The United States, I regret to say, is way, way far away on the opposite end of both scales. Portugal has a similar amount of inequality, but a much lower index of drug use. Canada is high on both indicators, high on economic inequality, high on drug use. We are indeed hungry, craving something that feeds more than bodies, and this is where our communities of faith, our communities of whatever type that promote meaning, are, if we choose to make them so, a safety barrier against drug abuse and addictions of all kinds. The real adversary in the drug war is not drugs, it is poverty. But not just poverty, for there are many poor countries where drug use is not at all a problem on the scale that it is here. The enemy, then, is poverty in the face of abundance. The enemy is economic injustice. The adversary is not drugs, it is loneliness in our fractured society. How many people do I know who have climbed to the top of the economic ladder and bought their dream house on acreage and then nearly perish from loneliness? How many people do we all know who are inhibited by pride or stubbornness from reaching out for the connection we all so desperately need? The adversary is not drugs. It is the fact that all too many of our young people, whether living in inner city slums or soulless suburbs, grow up in unstimulating environments where meaning and purpose are absent as our parents' enriching activities and love. The adversary is not drugs, it is the atomized, fragmented, mistrustful character of our society, exacerbated by hateful rhetoric that assaults, separates, and alienates us. We are hungry for something that feeds more than bodies. Liberal religious congregations provide some of the very best antidotes for these ills. Company, support, social action programs, and other meaningful activities. And above all, we offer spirituality for not only believers, but also atheists and agnostics. Spirituality, which means the experience of connection with something larger than the self, which is worthy of reverence. In an era when people are leaving the traditional church in droves in reaction to the contorted and corrupted version of Christianity that is so prominent in our consciousness, in this era, we must make it known that our congregations offer not the sole death of prejudice, fragmentation, and loneliness, but the soulful life of acceptance, caring, justice, and connection to something larger, something greater. And we must assure the continuation, the flourishing, and the health of these beloved communities. This is something worthy of our efforts, our devotion, our life energy, something that heals and connects us in life-giving ways, even as it helps to heal our hurting world. For we are the hungry. We want the loaves and the fishes, the water and the wine of sweet justice for all. May you be richly blessed. Amen. Can we all say amen with me? All right. Thank you. Or amen. Whatever you like.